This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Skenderis, and this is your World Tonight. UN peacekeepers are caught in the crossfire in the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah. After the murder of an Iranian woman in St. John's, advocates say immigrant women face serious hurdles getting help from intimate partner violence. And Uber drivers say they fear a new payment model will suppress their wages and increase fares for riders. But first, Florida is on a long road to recovery after Hurricane Milton. Hurricane Milton is in the rearview mirror. But for people in Florida, the recovery is just beginning. Across the state, there are still power outages, obstructed roads, and heavy flooding. Milton caused upwards of $50 billion U.S. dollars in damages and killed at least 17 people. Erin Collins is in Florida as people pick up the pieces from yet another catastrophic storm.
Good job, Ray.
The families are back at the marina in Fort Pierce, Florida. The storm clouds long gone, just 3 days after Hurricane Milton rumbled through. And as the sun comes out again, recovery efforts are ramping up across the state. On Florida's Atlantic coast, cleanup efforts are focused on communities hit by tornadoes.
It came from over there, right over the house this way, and kept going that way.
Places like Spanish Lakes, where Hank Pierce's home was destroyed. His house, not his only loss.
And I found three people dead over there. As soon as it went, I went outside, and I started looking for people. And
did you know them? Or?
Yeah, they were my neighbors. We all know each other here. It's a great community.
In all, six people died here after two tornadoes touched down. On the Gulf Coast, the storm was less deadly. Still, high winds and storm surge left their mark. But as people like Lee Towell return to the area, there's a feeling that things could have been much worse.
We really were expecting to see the whole place just gone. But to come home and also find four of the units completely missing their roofs wasn't exactly pleasant either. But at least our home is still standing.
Days after the storm has passed, flooding persists across Florida, too. Hillsborough County Sheriff Chad Cronister still working to evacuate people trapped in their homes by floodwater.
We're 6 feet deep. We have some people who believe that it might get as high as 20 feet.
Other problems persist, too. More than a million Floridians are still without power. Parts of the state still have gas shortages, too.
We're doing 10 gallons per customer.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis offering up free fuel today.
These public fuel sites, although we have done fuel support in the past, we've never done it to this scale. And that is on top of the amount of fuel that we provided directly to service stations.
Well, the president will visit the state on Sunday. Joe Biden says more federal help is on the way. It's needed. This state hammered by three hurricanes this year, with weeks still left in hurricane season. Erin Collins, CBC News, Tampa, Florida.
Israel is continuing its offensive on two fronts, Lebanon and Gaza. The IDF is warning people to leave northern Gaza as it ramps up airstrikes. In Lebanon, the UN peacekeeping mission says another member of its team has been wounded. It's just the latest incident in the past few days that has seen several peacekeepers injured. Michelle Song reports.
Family and friends surround an ambulance as they watch the bodies of their loved ones taken away, killed by an Israeli airstrike near the southern Lebanese city of Sidon. The death toll in Lebanon is on the rise, now more than 2,200 civilians killed since the fighting between Israel and the militant group Hezbollah began. And UN peacekeepers are also caught in the crossfire.
We have been attacked several times.
Andrew Tenenti is a spokesperson for the UN Interim Force in Lebanon, or UNIFIL. A fifth UN peacekeeper was injured by gunfire today. The origin of the shooting is still unknown. This comes after the Israeli Defense Forces confirmed to have opened fire yesterday near the UNIFIL headquarters, which injured other peacekeepers. Despite Israel's push to leave, Tennenti says they will not.
There was a decision, unanimous decision, to stay because it's important for the UN flag to still fly high in this region.
World leaders condemned Israel for targeting the peacekeeping operation. Tennenti says it's important for the international community to step up when it comes to this conflict.
This is really turning very soon into a regional conflict with catastrophic impact for everyone.
The IDF declared today a closed military zone in some towns along the Lebanon border, after many areas have evacuated over fears of more Hezbollah attacks. Gazans in the Jabalia refugee camp in the north of the Strip were also ordered to leave, fleeing once again after Israel launched a ground operation into the area a week ago, saying it is stopping Hamas from regrouping, killing dozens in the refugee camp. This could have been the 20th time or more that we've been displaced, says Bassem Alha. He has no idea where else to go or where he will even sleep.
We have no food that did enter into Gaza since the 1st of October.
Antoine Renard is with the World Food Program in Gaza. He says a million Gazans are at risk of going hungry.
Currently, we still have 8 kitchens in Gaza City that are operating, as well as 4 bakeries. The biggest fear we have is that we will run short very quickly.
Renard says the situation is dire and they may have to cut this lifeline for Gazans if supplies don't come in. Michelle Song, CBC News, Toronto.
Shots were fired at a Jewish girls' elementary school in Toronto's North York region for a second time. Police say they received reports of a smashed window at the Beis Chaya Mushka school around 4 a.m. local time. Further investigation found gunfire had damaged the building. No injuries have been reported. It happened on Yom Kippur, the most sacred holiday in the Jewish calendar. Inspector Paul Krawchuk is with Toronto Police.
We understand this is deeply unsettling for the Jewish community, especially on a day as sacred as Yom Kippur. Our priority is your safety, and we are committed to doing everything we can to find those responsible.
Krawchuk did not release information on potential suspects, but said the hate crime unit is involved. The school was also hit with gunfire in May. Still ahead, it's more than a trip down memory lane. Elders in Yellowknife are doing some mental time travel with the help of virtual reality. How modern technology is helping them get back on the land. That's coming up on Your World Tonight. The Prime Minister is facing a growing mutiny among disgruntled Liberal members of Parliament. CBC News has learned a number of MPs are coordinating an effort to force Justin Trudeau to step down as leader. At least 20 are believed to have signed a pledge to collectively call on Trudeau to resign. But it appears Trudeau has allies in cabinet. Here's what Trade Minister Mary Ng had to say.
I'm disappointed because Canadians expect us to be focusing on Canadians and doing this work. And I know my colleagues, I know that that is top of mind as we go home into our ridings, the issues that we're fighting for, whether it's pharmacare, whether it is, you know, making sure that housing is more affordable for people. I think that the conversations that we have in caucus, we remain in caucus.
Lori Turnbull is a political science professor at Dalhousie University.
Well, it's not good. And this isn't the first time over the past few months that MPs have organized themselves somehow to indicate that they're not confident in the Prime Minister taking them through the next election. And obviously, things have really hit very tense points in the House of Commons this week. And the Prime Minister was traveling, but the MPs weren't. They were there and they were living this situation where, you know, the opposition is really putting their feet to the fire and the deal with the NDP is off and the Bloc have demands and everything seems to be kind of falling apart. And the leader has not indicated what the strategy is going to be to make sure that they are competitive in the next election.
Multiple sources tell CBC News that frustration has been mounting in caucus now that an election could be called any time in this minority parliament. In Ontario, rideshare app Uber is changing how its drivers are paid. The new system has already rolled out in BC and across the US. As Philippe de Montigny reports, drivers say they will earn less.
while riders pay more.
George Wedge is an Uber driver in Toronto. A new algorithm now sets how much he'll earn for a ride before he accepts it, instead of being paid at the end of the trip based on time and distance.
It's based on something that's absolutely unknown to us.
With upfront offers, the algorithm takes into account things like time of day, historical trip data, and real-time demand at the destination.
Uber has found a way to take more money from us.
A Columbia University study conducted in the U.S., where this pay model has been in place for 2 years, shows Uber drivers earn less than before, 12% less in the first quarter of 2023.
I think it's taking an unfair system and making it vastly worse.
Brandon Agnew-Eiler is a spokesperson for RideFare, an advocacy group for ride-hailing app workers.
It's designed to drive wages down, and it allows them to drive fares up.
Uber tells CBC News upfront offers give drivers more transparency and choice when deciding whether to take a trip. The company admits fares have gone up, but so did driver pay. In the U.S., Uber says median earnings grew nearly 30% over the last 6 years. In BC, where upfront offers were launched last month, employers must pay gig workers a minimum wage of $20.88 per hour for engaged time. Still, RideFare worries AI could be paying workers different amounts for the same trip. Seven Uber drivers in the U.S. tested out this hypothesis.
He's getting paid a dollar more if he goes there, according to the map, and nobody else is. Nobody
with Lyft, which uses a similar tool, they found differences of up to $4.
So there is some algorithmic discrimination in that AI.
Erla Phillips, herself a driver for Uber, is vice president of the Rideshare Drivers Association of Ontario. She's calling on the province to crack down on the practice now.
The Gig Workers Act, you know, that received royal assent more than 2 years ago and it still has not gone into effect.
That Ontario legislation will take effect in July of next year. The Ministry of Labour did not answer specific questions from CBC News, but says the new protections will guarantee a minimum wage for each assignment, transparency around how work is assigned, and the right to know how their compensation is calculated. Uber did not say when or if it plans to roll out upfront offers elsewhere in the country. Philippe de Moncy, CBC News, Toronto.
The small Iranian community in St. John's is coming together to help a woman they barely had a chance to know. She had only recently come to Canada. But earlier this month, police in St. John's announced her body had been found in a suitcase. Her husband suspected of killing her. Ariana Gomez tells us more.
Baranabet arrived in Canada in May to reunite with her husband of 11 years, Mehdi Purbaghi, a PhD student at Memorial University. 2 months later, she was murdered.
The deceased, a 33-year-old woman from Iran, was found in the area of Water Street inside of a suitcase. The suspect has been identified as the spouse of the deceased.
Purbaghi's body was discovered in the couple's apartment 1 day before Abed's body was found. Police are still investigating and can't confirm if the deaths were a murder-suicide. Abed's killing has left the city's small Iranian community shattered. Mariam Hajedari is a member of Newfoundland and Labrador Iran Alliance.
Although most of us didn't actually know Baran and didn't get the opportunity to get to know Baran personally, but all of us related to her immigration journey somehow. It's truly heartbreaking to see that how her life got short in such a tragic way.
So there's a lot of work to be done here in this province.
For Sobia Sheikh, Baran Abed's murder highlights the issue of intimate partner violence. She's the local vice president of the Canadian Council of Muslim Women. And she says, for women like Abed, there are barriers that are invisible to the broader public.
We don't in Newfoundland and Labrador have the same level of cultural interpretation or translation. In other provinces like Ontario, there's actually companies that accredit translators.
She says many migrant women fear if they speak out, there will be consequences.
We've heard of cases where a woman calls for support and then is in danger of having her children taken away. And so women are scared of calling supports because they're afraid that of the impact on their families.
According to Sheikh, it's all about the connections. For immigrant women, having a network can make all the difference.
We don't build relationships often with newcomer families. Migrant women here, they're, because of racism, their families, their only support sometimes. So they're isolated.
Nearly 3 months later, Abed's body is still stuck in a place she never got the chance to call home.
The family has been waiting since July, and it has been very, very devastating for them to just waiting. Even they cannot grieve in the way that they want.
The community is fundraising to return Abed's remains to her family in Iran. But with strained relations between Canada and Iran and no Iranian embassy in this country, the repatriation effort is tangled in red tape. Ariana Gomez, CBC News, St. John's.
The Apprentice is one of the most talked about movies of the year, and it almost never saw the light of day.
Yes.
Hello, this is Donald Trump from Mr. Cohen. Thank you so much.
Donald who?
It depicts Donald Trump as a young upstart, as he is mentored by the ruthless attorney and Republican power broker, Roy Cohn. The movie failed to get distribution after its premiere at the Cannes Film Festival, in part because Trump's lawyers tried to block its release. But those efforts failed, and with just 23 days until the U.S. election, it's finally hitting theaters. Eli Glasner joined us with more. So, Eli, The Apprentice aims to show how Donald Trump became Donald Trump. Mm. Does it do that? Does it actually shine a new light?
I mean, certainly, unless you've read biographies about Donald Trump and the minutiae of New York City politics and real estate, I think there's a lot here that will be revelatory. This is a film that begins in the mid-70s, follows his rise close to the end of the 80s, when the book, The Art of the Deal, really cemented his reputation. But the main thesis is that much of the behavior of Donald Trump, always attack, deny everything, claim victory, comes from Roy Cohn, this notorious lawyer, a Republican fixer. And the movie suggests that Cohn basically noticed Trump and invited him into the circle and saw the potential.
I'm going to let you in on a little secret.
People, they hire me because I'm a winner.
How do you win?
The first rule is the simplest. Attack, attack, attack.
So the film shows Cohn almost becoming Trump's life coach, showing him how to fight back, how to distort the truth, using leverage, dirty tricks, and really helping Trump become established.
So Trump's re-election team hasn't had the kindest of words for this movie. No. They've called it pure malicious defamation. You recently went to a screening with a director, Ali Abbasi. Does he agree with that? How is he framing this?
He does not agree with that. And I had this fascinating experience, and this has never happened to me all my time as a critic. Back in September at the Toronto International Film Festival, they hosted a screening for critics, a special screening, actually wasn't necessarily part of the festival. Now, Ali Abbasi is the director. He's a Danish-Iranian filmmaker. And he asked us, the critics, to stick around after the screening because he wanted to ask us some questions. Uh-huh. And mainly what he asked is, did we think his film was fair to Donald Trump? And I find that fascinating. This is a film that shows Trump getting liposuction. This is a film that shows him getting a hair transplant. It shows his very dysfunctional relationship with his then wife, Ivana, including a rape scene, which she has testified about during her divorce proceedings. And so Abbasi is trying to craft a film that he thinks, and he said to us, could be seen by anyone, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. When he actually told an anecdote about when he showed this film in Telluride, a number of women who saw it and enjoyed it came up to him and said, we couldn't tell if you were a Republican or a Democrat. And he took that as a point of pride.
Yeah.
That's the impression he wants to make with this film.
Okay, so let's talk about the timing of this movie. Yeah. I read an interview where they seem to say that the timing was kind of a coincidence. Election day is not so far away in the U.S. I find that a little bit hard to believe because, I mean, this is great timing for this movie to come out. But do you think that this movie actually has the power to change anyone's mind about Donald Trump?
I would be very skeptical on that. I don't think the MAGA base is going to go anywhere near this. I suppose it could change the mind of the highly coveted independent voters. But I do wonder if the low information voters that both sides are trying to reach are going to go watch a 2-hour art film about Donald Trump and his lawyer.
Okay,
So final question, should they go watch this 2.5-hour film about Donald Trump and his lawyer? Did you think it was any good?
I did. Mainly the performances. Sebastian Stan, he plays Donald Trump. It is not easy to humanize one of the most famous people on the planet. But I would say even better is Jeremy Strong. He plays Roy Cohn as this spray-tanned master of the dark arts. It is amazing to watch. My caveat would be, we see where Trump got the playbook, but I still don't understand the motivation, what drove him. And so in that respect, I found it lacking. Amazing performances, but there are still many Trump stories waiting to be told.
Eli, thank you.
My pleasure.
The CBC's Eli Glasner in Toronto. Canadian colleges and universities are showing growing interest in competitive video games. Clubs for esports are popping up on campuses across the country. Sensing an opportunity, one New Brunswick university is backing its club with money and new training facilities. Rhythm Ratty brings us this look at the possible future of varsity athletics.
3, 2, 1, go!
For Simon Sigier, a round of Super Smash Bros. Ultimate isn't just fun and games with friends, it's competition. He and his U Moncton esports teammates take practice seriously, putting in up to 20 hours per week.
I would spend hours in there just practicing movement, for example, testing how my character feels, practicing combos, like chain attacks together.
Sigier often had to practice at home alone, but not anymore. He and his U Moncton esports teammates can now work together in the new on-campus gaming space. The club's current president, Camille Pelletier, was involved in pitching the idea to the university. She says the school now sees the value in it.
We made the higher-ups of the university kind of realize that it was needed and that other universities are starting as well, so we shouldn't fall behind, right?
The University of Moncton inaugurated their esports room mid-September. It is equipped with 5 advanced gaming stations, ergonomic chairs, and RGB lighting, as well as 4 screens attached to multiplayer gaming consoles. Similar esports rooms have opened at schools like Ontario's Durham College, as well as Fort McMurray and Bow Valley College in Alberta.
And I think it's more of a grassroots, bottom-up incentive rather than a strategic decision being made top-down.
These rooms are often student-led initiatives, says Paul Dervazi. The gaming expert and University of Toronto lecturer says colleges and universities are starting to recognize esports as legitimate. Some are even designing curriculums around esports. Dervazi says having gaming clubs and practice spaces on campus can benefit both the student body and the school.
When you go and compete and there's visibility around your university and your success, you create a market presence because universities are also businesses. And this is certainly a way that the university can create a presence for themselves in a very timely sport that has an enormous following.
For Camille Pelletier's part, she says esports may become a viable career opportunity for skilled players, and she hopes to see it treated as seriously as other varsity sports.
Eventually, I mean, the long-term goal would be to, you know, get scholarships for players just like we get scholarships for, you know, football players or whatever.
Pelletier says there's a lot of talent on campus, and the esports club will be holding tryouts to pick teams for games like League of Legends, Valorant, Street Fighter VI, and others. On top of creating the esports room, the University of Moncton has also set aside $60,000 over 3 years to cover the esports team's travel expenses to tournaments. Rhythm Rati, CBC News, Moncton, New Brunswick.
A new project in the Northwest Territories is marrying tradition with modern technology. It's using virtual reality to bring elders out of their homes and back to the land. Natalie Pressman explains.
Noel Drybones is in a wheelchair, but he says drumming always makes him want to dance.
Everybody should be dancing. Why are you hanging around?
The 81-year-old Cleachaw elder lives in the seniors' home in Bechacon, Northwest Territories, about 100 kilometers from Yellowknife. Drybones says it's been decades since he played in hand games, but with the help of a virtual reality headset, he can now take part without ever leaving home.
So it brings it back, so help me memories.
The VR goggles allow the seniors to visit 10 locations, including a drum dance, a hide tanning camp, grave sites. or out on a fishing boat. That's where Johnny Simpson wants to go.
This chicken and this is taking a whitefish.
It's a project from the Klejon government, and for those who can't travel, it brings the land to them. Two headsets live at the Beshakaw Seniors Home.
A lot of our local elders have become immobile, and for them to use the VR, I think it takes them back to when they were kids.
Julia Nedzo is the facility coordinator at the home. She says the headsets make the seniors happy.
You see their smile and their laughter when we were showing it to them.
Sarah Power is a nurse at the home.
This is a way to kind of help bring that back to them as best we can so that they don't feel so much a sense of loss from coming to live in a home.
University of Victoria psychology professor Steve Lindsay says using VR in this way is a kind of mental time travel.
When you recollect an earlier experience or put yourself in the mental state of an earlier time in your life, it's not like a separate little thing. You, to some extent, your current self becomes more like your earlier self.
Lindsay says it probably doesn't have lasting benefits, but he says if it brings people joy, it's still worthwhile.
You know, if you can enable people to have a nice time, that's a good thing to do.
Staff who worked on the project say it's not a replacement for traveling to the land, but an alternative for those who aren't able to get there. Natalie Pressman, CBC News, Yellowknife. I hope you make it, 'cause I've been chasing another odyssey.
That's the latest from The Weeknd. Dancing in the Flames from his upcoming album, Hurry Up Tomorrow. The Weeknd has done well on streaming platforms for a long time. Over on Spotify, he became the first artist to hit 100 million monthly listeners back in February 2023. And he's held onto that status ever since. But now, he's broken his own record, growing his monthly listeners to more than 120.5 million. And that's not even his only recent Spotify success. A couple of weeks ago, his 2020 song After Hours entered Spotify's so-called Billions Club by hitting a billion streams. That put The Weeknd ahead in this particular rivalry with fellow Torontonian Drake by breaking their 17-song tie. And no, that's not all. Blinding Lights off that same 2020 album remains the most streamed song on Spotify at nearly 4.5 billion. While The Weeknd's success is cemented, it's not clear if Spotify's is as secure. It's raising its prices again in Canada. Individual accounts are going up by $1.70, family accounts by $4. It's Spotify's second increase in just over a year, and it'll happen in the next couple of months. So if you're thinking about what rising subscription fees are doing to your wallet, well, here's a song for that. This is Dancing in the Flames on Your World Tonight. I'm Stephanie Skanderis. Thank you for listening. And it's amazing, 'cause I can taste it, our final odyssey. Oh, I can't wait to see your face when we're switching lanes. My love's beyond the pain. But if I miss the break.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.